Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a network on the New Books Network. I'm Jana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Karl Schlügel, Professor Emeritus at the Europa Universität Viadrina, Frankfurt, to talk about his new book, The Scent of Empire, Chanel No. 5 and Red Moscow, out this year, 2021, with Polity Press. Hello, Professor. How are you today?
Hello. I'm fine, thank you. We have beautiful weather in Berlin, despite the pandemic crisis.
You're under a tight lockdown as well, are you not?
Pardon?
You're under a tight lockdown as well in Berlin, yes?
Yes, but it was a little bit opened, and yesterday we walked and strolled in the city and changed the landscape, the cityscape changed a bit, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I think we can see a light at the end of the tunnel, yes? Let's hope. Okay. I really enjoyed your book. I want to start there. So I'm looking at your long and very your really productive career, and I see you've made a career of studying Russia and its influence in the 20th century. So your book titles Moscow 1937, Ukraine, a Nation on the Borderlands, Russian-German Special Relations in the 20th Century, et cetera, right? So I see a pretty clear kind of political history trend. And this book seems a bit different, as if it's on a slightly different path. How did you come to write The Scent of Empire?
Yeah, that's true. It's a bit surprising that somebody who has dealt with history of the Russian Revolution, with Stalinism, decided to talk or to write about flacons and perfumes and scent. And somebody asked me, how is it possible that a serious historian on Russian and Soviet history dedicated his book to Karl Lagerfeld? There are worlds between the world of Karl Lagerfeld and the Soviet history. No, it's quite simple, I have to say. I was years ago writing a book on, it was called Archaeology of Communism, and I had always in mind to write one page about scent, about smell. Because I lived several years in Moscow and in then Leningrad, doing studies and archival work. And there was one thing I was always amazed, and this was a specific scent. And especially at very festive opportunities, for instance, in the concert in the Philharmonia or in the inauguration of some anniversaries or in the universities, and it was always connected to a certain scent, and I had this in my nose, and I just tried to find out where from did it come. And I read cultural history of Russian authors, And they told me, yes, this is called a perfume, a very popular perfume, Krasnaya Moskva, Red Moscow. So I had the name. But what was much more fascinating and a bit shocking, that there was written that this perfume, this most popular perfume, has been created even before the Soviet time, before the Russian Revolution. And so there was opened a way for research and following the traces where from did come this very popular scent. But I have to say, somebody living in Berlin and crossing the border at these checkpoints, you always had a feeling that there's a kind of great divide, even in the dimension of scent and smell. Going across, for instance, at the checkpoint Friedrichstrasse, you had the impression that you are leaving the sector of Western world, the supermarkets, etc., and entering an entirely different scentscape, which was entirely different. So I had always a feeling that there are two worlds with differently smelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you write about that very convincingly. Well, you open the book with this vignette. So it's 1920, and Coco Chanel and Ernst Beaux are meeting in Beaux's laboratory in Cannes. An introduction arranged by Dmitry Pavlovich Romanov, who was Chanel's lover and a Russian Grand Duke in exile in France. And it's all very glamorous, right? And it's in this intoxicating scene. And it's the scene where Coco Chanel chooses Chanel number 5. So what happens there? How does she come to do this? Like, how does she choose this?
I know from biographies of Chanel that she was in a kind, she believed in some numbers, and she always decided number 5. And when Ernest Beaux presented her a selection of his compositions, he had about 25 examples or samples of his newly created scent, she decided 5. And the number 5 is obviously for her very important. And later on, she decided to choose the 5th of the 5th month to present her collection. And in this sense, we have, a 100th anniversary this year. She believed in the number 5. And I think it has to do with her bringing up or
something.
Her beliefs, yes.
So then we shift over to Russia, and the atmosphere changes completely. I think I could hear the song of the Volga boatmen playing quietly in the background while I read this description of the Russian perfume industry in the years after the Russian Revolution. And now we have the House of Bokhar that has become State Soap Factory number 5, later renamed Novaya Zarya. And it's here that a master perfumer, August Ippolitovich Michel, created Red Moscow. And that's a very different scene, right? We have an artist creating a scent.
Yes, that's true. That's an amazing story, I have to say. After the revolution, the French perfume industry, and they had the most prominent factories in the Tsarist and the Russian Empire, they were immediately nationalized. And both factories, Brocard, and for which Michel worked, and Raleigh, for which Ernest Bohr worked, they were nationalized. And in after the comeback of the economy, they were reunified in a state-owned trust, TG, it was called. And he was the chief perfumer of these Soviet-owned perfume trust. And there he created, based on his knowledge of pre-revolutionary perfume industry, these new brands of Soviet perfumes. And I mean, we know quite well the story of Ernest Bohr in the West. I mean, he made a career, beautiful career, after coming back from Russia after the Civil War in France. But Michel is a quite different different case. He remained in Russia. It's not quite clear why. Obviously, he lost his papers. He could not emigrate, as most of the French community in St. Petersburg and Moscow did. He stayed there, and he agreed to work and to reconstruct the perfume industry. And obviously, and later on, when the diplomatic relations between France and the Soviet Union were established, he got a passport, but he did not want to leave the country. Obviously, he was fascinated to do this job in the newly created Soviet perfume industry. But his fate ended, as we know, not very happily. We know only from an interview made in 1936 that he was the teacher of a new generation of Soviet perfumers. He created new brands, but in 1937, in the years of the Great Purges and the Great Terror, he disappeared. And it's not clear, was he involved into the purges? That means, did he suffer from the purges? Was he killed, executed, or deported? Or did he just disappear in the vast space of the Soviet Empire? We don't know. But a lot of foreigners or foreign-born people in the Soviet Union in these 30s suffered a lot from the Stalinist state terror.
Yeah. The time of the Great Purges, I mean, few people came out of that well, right?
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about setting this up, the juxtaposition of these two scenes. And they really set up the book. And I would like to know how you chose to start here, why you wanted to put, you know, this like light breezy Chanel chooses a thing versus the state soap factory number 5 creation of Red Moscow. Why did you start here?
I started there because I knew the story of the Soviet perfume, Krasnaya Moskva, Red Moscow, and I did not know up to this point that there's the story of Chanel. And I just brought together two stories which have been perceived and read always as separately and entirely different stories. On one side, there was the Chanel and Chanel number 5 story, and on the other side, the Red Moscow story. And the fascinating thing for me was that both came from the same background. That means from French perfume culture in the first wave of globalization in the pre-war time, and both perfumes created in a very paradoxical situation. That means on the occasion of the 300th anniversary of the Romanov dynasty, that means dedicated to a dynasty which was deemed to fall. in the years after. And so I tried to come back to the common origin of two remarkable perfumes, which in a divided world after 1917 had their own careers, but that they had a joint origin or background in the first wave of globalization in the pre-revolutionary days. That was fascinating. And I made some observations, for instance, that the Flacon number 5 was in a great exhibition in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, but nobody had an idea that there was a Soviet perfume which was also very prominent, and only after the end of the great divide of the world, after the end of the Cold War, it seemed to me that we could reunify the world, the divided world of scent. So this was the conclusion I came. I never had a plan to write a story of scent in the 20th century or to write a story of the 20th century along the development of scents, but it became clear for me that there is a lot of common features in these development, in the careers of the creators of the people who created the world of scent.
Well, let's talk about the two women who you focus on here, Coco Chanel and then Polina. Oh, I'm going to murder this. Zemshuzina Molotova. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you spend a lot of time with the two of them, and their stories are really important in helping us to understand the way Europe moved on. I mean, if not necessarily forward, in the 20th century post Great War, in this age of extremes, as Habsbawm's going to call it. Why these two women?
It was only discovering the traces. I had not on my display in the first moment to make this comparison between these two careers, but it is so obvious. I mean, the career of Gabrielle Chanel we know quite well. Born in 1883 and she died in 1971. And we had many biographies and telling about her pioneer work in modernizing and revolutionizing women's dress, her ideas of a new modern, simple, practicable fashion. We knew her relations to the Russian community in Paris. We know also about her cooperation with the Germans during the occupation of France. And her second war, after the Second World War career, her take off again. That we know in all details. When I started to deal with the Red Moscow, I realized that there is also another carrier. This is Polina Shemchuzhina Molotova. I mean, we mostly know the name of Vyacheslav Molotov, the second man behind Stalin, the author or partner of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in 1939, etc., a lifelong cooperator and partner of Stalin. And we did not know, or we perceived his wife only in the shadow of this second man behind Stalin. But in fact, she had her own career. She was born in 1897. She entered from very humble social background. She was born in a Jewish shtetl, a little town in the close to Kiev, in the south of the former Russian Empire. She entered the revolution and civil war, and she got to know Vyacheslav Molotov very early in 2021 or 22. And she was working in the nationalized perfume industry since the 20s. She made a career and she became even the people's commissar for light industry. And she was the only person, the only woman who took this job, the highest job of this ministry. Her fate then was entirely different from Chanel's. After the war, she was accused to have relations to nationalistic and so-called Zionist circles. She was accused, she was excluded from the party, and she was sent into exile in behind the Urals, and she spent 5 years in this exile, and she came back in 1953, and she was liberated from exile and from prison 5 days after the day when Stalin died. And she was shocked because she was a believer. She believed in Stalin. And up to the end of her life. But we have to say that that she never succumbed did accept the accusations which were made against her in this case in the late 40s. So she was a tough woman, or a term I would like to use from the Russian literature, Zheleznaya Zhenshchina, the Iron Woman. And in a certain way, Coco Chanel and Polina Shemchujina, they are for me different forms of this generation of Iron Woman in the early or the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, because Coco Chanel appears to believe in nothing. Her political position, just she's not interested, and she will side with anyone, as opposed to Polina, who is a true believer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. I'd like to talk for a minute about your decision to use scent as an historical lens. This is also new for you, and I'm curious about how you interacted with the historiography. So I'd actually like to take a second and read from the English translation of the book. The slightest disruption to our everyday smells, uncollected rubbish, for instance, pops the deodorized bubble in which we usually live, causes irritation and unease. We must make an effort to bear a stench. We suffer not only from the tyranny of intimacy, but from the world of smells produced by that intimacy. We do not want it to touch us. Progress is measured by the suppression of stench, and what we consider pleasant or repugnant is an aspect of the lordship-bondage relationship described by Hegel and Marx, the struggle between the center and the periphery, between above and below, between people living in close proximity, between the West and the non-European world. Now, I realize those actually may seem like weird words to you because you've written in German, but it's so beautiful. I just want to stop and revel in that prose. It's such a beautiful paragraph. It's evocative and effective, and I like get it on what you're saying. And you elevate our noses. And I suddenly had to see a discussion about the nature of progress itself centering on the nose. And I want to talk about this. You're like using scent as an historical lens. Like, there's so much about the interaction between memory and sense of smell. On some level, if history is institutionalized and formalized societal memory, we should be engaging with smell all the time, but we don't. How did you make this decision? Why did you decide to engage here? Did it strike you that like smell is an interesting thing? I don't know.
Yes, thank you for this quotation. I mean, it's again a very elementary observation. To follow the senses, which is very important. There is a kind of hierarchy in that theory is much more than experience, that will is much more than the existence, that theory is based mostly on one sense, that means the eye, the visuality, or the ear, the audio scape. And if you take, or I'm convinced that you can write history, a complex history, which reflects the complexity of life, you have to refer or to bring into all your senses, the eye, the ear, the taste, the nose, etc. And some people, like Schopenhauer or Nietzsche, they were convinced that the odor, the smell, and the sense, this sense is so important as to the visual sense. So I think historiography should take into account all senses. And for instance, you, from my field, you cannot write a history of the Russian Revolution without describing the changing landscape, the changing sensescape or soundscape in during the process of revolution, the social tribulations, the social changes are reflected in all dimensions, and I'm interested to bring back all these different dimensions of experience, and not only one. And I think this will give historiography a much fuller and more embracing capacity to understand what is going on. And I mean, we all know this this situation in Marcel Proust's A la recherche du temps perdu, that one moment can bring back the entire world of your childhood in one moment. Yeah. And this is an everyday experience, and historians should also paying respect to these everyday and elementary experiences.
Absolutely. Like, you know, we know this, that memory and is really linked to scent. For instance, Chanel No. 5 is the perfume of my mother. And just thinking about it, I smell it, I conjure, I'm 7, you know, and she's getting ready to go out. It's very cool. Mm. But, and perfume is an attempt really to crystallize a moment, to cement this moment in time in like this olfactory scent way. But at the same time, these are fleetings. These are very fleeting scents. Like, we don't know what Red Moscow smelled like before, nor really Chanel No. 5. I mean, that's problematic, right? How do you do a history of this moment that's lost? Au temps perdu.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really very, very tough question. And I tried to get in contact with the Osmotique, the Museum of Scents and Perfumes in Versailles, and other museums. And they have their copies, and you can go through the register and the entirely repertoire of scents. There is one way. You have the chemistry, you have the experts for chemistry, and they can rediscover, reanalyze the composition of perfumes as far as they exist. The problem with the common origin of Chanel No. 5 and Red Moscow is that the original flacon and the original flacons, which existed in the pre-revolutionary time from 1913, they do not exist, and the flacons, yes, but without content. So there's the way of trusting or based on chemistry. The other way is description. I mean, the perfumers have a prose which is very, very elaborated. And we have descriptions of how it smells. And I especially quoted the memoirs of another perfumer who came together with Beau from Russia to France, Konstantin Verigin. And he just has written a kind of encyclopedia of the scents of the from the dawn of the empire. I mean, he came from a very well-to-do and rich aristocratic family, but he is describing the entirely repertoire of the scents of his childhood, of the school class, of the streets on the Crimea, where they were in the summer holidays. He is describing the odor and smell of the woods and the fields. And so I think description is one way to try to objectivize what smell and scent is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a problem that art historians deal with as well. How do you talk about, you know, colors as that may not be with us anymore, but scents much more fleeting.
Right.
But you devote a chapter to the development of the new woman that represents this profound and purposeful break with the past that's really striking in the 20th century, which is part of the study of parallel lives that you have of Nadezhda Lomonosova, mm-hmm. sorry,
yeah.
and Coco Chanel. Can you comment on this, the new woman, and comparing these women?
Yeah, Coco Chanel is mm-hmm. not only the branding Chanel No. 5. She has made history in fashion by her, the creation of the black
the little black dress, the LBD.
Yes, right. And yes, I had a chapter, or this is a chapter about fashion, because it's very surprising that there are parallels too. And Nadezhda Lomonosova, she came also from the pre-revolutionary time. And she entered the way of how to get rid of the old-fashioned Belle Époque fashion. And it's very strange and fascinating to see that you have parallel movements in designing the new clothes of the modern woman. It should be simple. It should be practical. It should be helping women to combine a family and work. And the 20s in the Soviet Union was the time of avant-garde, of experimenting with colors, with every every type of design, not only fashion, furniture, etc., etc. And there was one very important exhibition in Paris, 1925, the exposition of Art Deco. And I would say this is one situation and one point where two different ways of modernity, of modern design, came together. There was a very prominent appearance of Soviet costume designers, fashion, and the French. These parallel, or when I tried to parallelize the type of thinking and the type of expectations and the parallel of forms, it is not my projection, or I think mm-hmm. it was really a parallel development in these early 20th century modernity.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, and then you describe this very close relationship between the beautiful people of Paris and Moscow in the whole of the first half of the 20th century, a list of regular commuters that includes a good number of cultural heavy hitters who determined not only couture trends, but also intellectual fashions. So perfume here, I mean, it's another way of connecting the story of high culture and the intelligentsia, yeah?
I mean, this relation was, it's a chapter for itself. Karl Lagerfeld was always talking about the Russian connection in Paris, and we have to imagine or to reflect that Paris was in the 1910s, in the immediate decade before the revolution, and in the 20s, it was a center of the Russian world. I mean, of artists, of writers, but also the aristocracy. And after the revolution, thousands of people, refugees from the October Revolution. And they all brought something with them, and especially taste, culture, refined style, etc. And a lot of these people worked also for Gabrielle Chanel, and she was very close to the Russian artist community. I mean, Sergei Diaghilev, as the grand entrepreneur of the arts, the impresario of the Ballet Russe and the Saison Russe, etc. But there was a movement in the other direction too. The left intelligentsia from Paris moved to Moscow to see the creation of the new world. I mean, up to the 30s, when André Gide and other people traveled to Moscow, of course, disappointed after what they realized, what took place with the show trials, and especially after the Hitler-Stalin Treaty in 1939. But this was a very stable and a very intensive bridge and transfer of taste, culture, ideas, and which was broken, in fact, in the consequence of the war, and especially this very, very long Cold War, when we did not know what happened on the other side. And I have many other examples. For instance, Christian Dior, another very important person. He was in the late 20s with other people, Le Corbusier and others, in Moscow. And he came back in the 50s, and his presentation of his fashion in 59, it was a great cultural event, bringing back and reconstructing the intellectual and the stylistic relations which existed before before the wartime.
We see the parallel kind of development of the new woman. We see these intellectual connections, an ongoing love affair that the left has with the ideas of the Russian Revolution, if not how they play out. We see, you know, this ongoing conversation, and then you have in your final chapter, you talk about another connection. Another way we can see this parallel development, which is about the very famous perfume bottles. And again, full of these surprise connections. So I'm enchanted by the design for the perfume bottle, for the Perfume North, which is this bottle that looks like an iceberg topped by a polar bear. And that it's beautiful and very fascinating. But the real story, I think, is about the Spartan minimalist glass cube. That's the bottle for Chanel No. 5. Yes. And that's in the MoMA, right? Yeah.
Yes.
But and it's long been linked to abstract popular art, and you cite the Dutchman Piet Mondrian as an example. But you propose something else about the bottle for Chanel No. 5.
To discover or to see that the master of the modern painting, Kazimir Malevich, was the designer of the most popular bottle of Eau de Toilette 70, the North, it was really a kind of shock for me, which brought me to understand about that millions of people used this beautiful designed bottle of the with the polar bear beer. They did not know about that it was created by Kazimir Malevich. And I also, as somebody who knows something about painting, about the avant-garde, I had no idea that this genius was in 1910 just making money for his family, working in the Bocar fabric to design this bottle. So, yeah, this was really a great surprise. And the idea is finally to, at the end of the division of the world, to bring together the stories, the different stories, and my proposal is to bring back, to bring together the bottle of number 5, Chanel number 5, and Krasnaya Moskva in Moscow, and the Malevich designed bottle. It would be very interesting, but in the moment all these museums are closed as far as I know.
Yeah, right now we're not seeing anything. There are pictures in the book of flasks, like Soviet flasks, which evoke Chanel No. 5 as well.
I didn't understand the flask.
These vodka bottles, basically.
Yes. I'm sorry, I did not answer your question.
No problem. Yeah. Of course.
Yes, there's always the interpretation, mostly of art historians, that the Chanel design, these clear-cut forms, these transparent and anti-ornamentalistic, anti-floral design, is the spirit of the epoch. This is true, but they bring it mostly together with the ideas of constructivism, with Piet Mondrian's painting, etc. This geometrization and these clear-cut lines of design. But when I looked first at the designs of the bottles of Raleigh and Brocard, but especially of Raleigh in Russia, it seemed to me quite clear. I mean, this is a thesis of my thesis. I cannot finally prove it, but I'm quite sure that the original design comes from the bottles used by the members of the Tsarist army containing vodka under any circumstances. And these are, they were called in the German Baltic, with the German Baltic name, Stoff. And these are small bottles, mostly green or brown color, sometimes also transparent. And in these bottles, they had their portion of vodka, which is in sun, in cold climate or temperature, always should always with you. And if you put these Stoff bottles, if you compare these Stoff bottles with the Raleigh and the Chanel No. 5 bottle, it's quite clear it's not Piet Mondrian, but it's rather the bottle which has this origin, as I think, I believe correctly.
It's fairly convincing just looking at the pictures. I'm like, well, I recognize that bottle. And it's certainly something about that's in the air about just utility, right? And the idea of the utility of the age. I find this is something I'm very impressed by the book that I'm kind of going to take away with me, this connection between what we consider, you know, these very different worlds as exemplified by a luxury product is amazing to me.
Yeah.
There's...
I cannot explain, but all what Gabrielle Chanel created and helped to create, it's just the creation of a genius. She had a feeling for what is perfect, and the design of the Chanel 5 is just perfect. You cannot develop this form. You cannot transform it or to make it better. It's a perfect form. And the same is the case, I would say, with the clothes she designed. It's perfect. You cannot make it better. You can make something different things, but this type of this subject is perfect, and this is, I would say, the reason why it is still the most popular and most accepted and most admired thing which exist in fashion or in perfume industry.
Yeah, it's very hard to argue with the House of Chanel. Although, I mean, I see something as beautiful, as functional, and as interesting, at least in fashion, I see it with Lamanova's work as well. It's just beautiful things. You know, so this, but this takeaway about the connection between Paris and Moscow is and the luxury and the high culture is fascinating. And I would like to, before we close, I'd like to take a turn to discuss 23 Nikolskaya Street and the proposed plan here. Can you tell us what's going on with this in Moscow?
I know that still they are organized by the very important non-government organization Memorial tours around the Lubyanka, this place or the square in the center of Moscow, where all the center of the secret police of NKVD and today FSB is. And across the Lubyanka Square is Nikolskaya Street, and number, I think, 23. And number 23, I know it from, I have been quite often, because there's some institutes and bookstores. There's an house empty since years, and they try to, and there's an entrepreneur or businessman who tries to get this house to establish a fashionable restaurant, bookstore, wine store, etc., and a perfume store.
Mm-hmm.
And the scandalous thing is that this is one of the most contaminated places in Moscow. It was the site of the war criminal court, where immediately there have been judged thousands of people, and where in the next surrounding have been executed thousands of people. And the organization Memorial is fighting since years for establishing a memorial site for the dozens of thousands of people who have been judged in this place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very strange thing that at the memorial site for the victims of the Stalin time terror should be established
this luxury goods shopping mall.
Shopping mall for luxury goods, including perfumes. So
it's gross.
Yeah, it's bizarre, and it's not. I did not invent it, but in a certain way, history is always following some traces which are unexpected and. Mm-hmm. And surprising. I do not know the last moment what is going on now, but there are going on discussions, as you probably know, how to renovate the place before the square, before in front of the Lubyanka structure. And there's going on a discussion of the restoration of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the first chief of the JK and the secret police. And it's open what will happen.
But it's just, it's telling, right? It's this interesting kind of flashpoint that you have in the home of the secret police, where tens of thousands of people are sentenced to death, that there's this idea that you should have a perfume store there and that this is so problematic, right? Because the idea of a wine store, coffee shop, bookstore, perfume, these luxury goods that are so enjoyable sitting on top of this place that's so, as you said, contaminated, is really alarming, and it's really striking nerves.
I mean, it's the problem how a society, a given society, in this case the Russian society, is dealing with its past and to come to terms with the past. And I mean that the intervention of Memorial is very, very necessary. And I mean, they have an initiative in this moment to make signs on the houses where people disappeared and have been victimized. It's called the last address. And this, of course, is not only one last address. In this house have been. Decided the fates of at least some 10,000, 40,000 people. And in the context of the book, of course, the husband of Polina Shemchuzhina, Vyacheslav Molotov, he was one of the most of the people who signed the judgments together with Stalin and others. I think retelling the entire story of the tragedies and of unbelievable tragedies and fates of people is very, very necessary. And I'm hopeful that the Russian society will come to terms with it.
Well, just to bring this discussion back to scent, you in the book you cite a protest, the suggested protest, which is the creation of a fragrance called Composition Number 23 for 23 Nikolskaya Street. And in protest of the idea of putting a perfume store there, someone has developed this, you know, they proposed this. It's obviously satirical, but Composition Number 23 opens with notes of the old papers and inks that were used to sign the death sentences. The story continues with the aroma of a damp basement, soon followed by the main ingredient, a sharp smell of gunpowder, which is gradually replaced by a note of ash, leaving behind a bitter aftertaste, which is such an evocative and appropriate protest.
Yeah, this was the idea of some people from Memorial. And I read it in Novaya Gazeta, in one of the leading oppositional or liberal newspapers which still exist. And we have to look what is going on with this initiative and with the preservation of the place and the site of memory.
Wonderful. Okay, I've taken up so much of your time. I just have a couple more questions. So what is next? What are you working on now, Professor?
As you know, it's not good to talk about books which are in work in progress. But it may be very surprising. I decided after having been 2 years in Los Angeles to write my book on America, and it will be a kind of parallel book to which I have published 3 years ago, and which is also coming out in English, The Soviet Century. And it is my view on America, which I visited since the late 60s, so I have some experience. And of course, my perspective is a comparative perspective. What looks like and what is different entering Russia and entering America. So I hope it will be, I will try to come to terms with my image of these two worlds.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this. I'm looking forward to reading this, should it happen. I mean, not good, right? I don't want to jinx you. I want to end just by congratulating you heartily on this book. You're an award-winning historian, and it's no surprise that it is an outstanding book, that it's an excellent piece of history, really well-researched. I was just so impressed by the craft of the book and the storytelling. I don't know anyone to whom I would not recommend it. Halfway through reading it, I stopped to pre-order a copy for my brother in the States, who has a longstanding relationship with Bulgakov's Master and Margarita, and he will eat this book up. So congratulations on that. And listeners, go to our website, newbooksnetwork.com, and follow the link to Bookshop to order this. Go directly to your local bookstore and order this. I cannot say strongly enough, you will not be sorry. Read this book. Thank you so much for writing it, Professor Shlogel. And thank you so much for your time. I wish you a lovely rest of your day and a lovely 2021.
I thank you very much for this wonderful talk. Thank you.
All right. Tschüss.